ladies and gentlemen, I should like first to thank the Deputy Premier for his very kind words. Actually, his memory is remarkable, because that program he referred to was a very long time ago. It was actually called Small World. And the incident that he referred to was one that sticks very clearly in my memory. Ed Murrow and myself were talking in different parts of the world, were talking to the French Minister of Education, Jacques Soustelle. And we did get onto this subject of leaks and background information. And Soustelle delivered himself the remarkable opinion that a leak was misinformation which you circulated to damage your enemies, and background information was misinformation that you circulated to damage your friends. Speaking as a journalist of some 50 years, I thought that was a very accurate account. May I also be allowed to say, thanking the Deputy Premier for his kind welcome, that I did have, as a matter of fact, this afternoon, the very great pleasure of a conversation with the Premier, which was utterly delightful and interested me for one special reason, among others, that I would like to state publicly. I thought that I was pretty immune to the various distortions that the media engage in against anybody who attempts to stand up for the basic values of our way of life. But I must admit that I had become in some degree infected with the monstrous parody of your Premier that they project, because I was not prepared for so honest, so serious, and so Christian an encounter. I think it's disgraceful the manner in which, because of the position that he's taken, that he should be treated in the way he has been. And above all, I think it's disgraceful that among those who attempt to hurt and embarrass him are various members of the clergy. As it happens, I can give a small example of the sort of thing that goes on. When I arrived in Adelaide some week or 10 days ago, I was asked at the airport what I thought of the various changes that have been made in the law of South Australia relating to abortion particularly, and to divorce, and to the legalization of homosexual practices. And I said simply that I considered that this was a certain step in the direction of the kind of decadence and general breakdown of all moral behavior which had occurred in other countries like Scandinavia. Anyway, the same evening, the Attorney General of South Australia, whose name I don't know, let off a blast about this and said that if there had been any truth whatever in what I was saying, then the situation in Queensland would be appreciably better in regard to, for instance, sexual crimes than in South Australia, whereas in fact it was the other way around. Now, the interesting thing is that I wouldn't have been able myself to answer this effectively, but we had with us the associated with the Festival of Light, a very remarkable young Australian, Dr. John Court, and he wasn't going to accept all this and got out the figures. And of course, this statement by the Attorney General was totally untrue. Totally untrue. It was exactly the other way around, based on the figures. He demonstrated this with chapter and verse, and I may say not one single word appeared in any paper of his total confutation of a public statement made by a member of the government. And I consider, again, this is another example of the fact that indeed is obvious here in this country, obvious in Britain, obvious in America, that somehow or other the media have got harnessed to the devil's view of what is going on in the world, in the Western world, namely of always approving of everything which is dragging our society down, always commending what is dark and evil, and always ridiculing and distorting what is good. There's a quotation I often use from a French writer whom I greatly admire, Simone Weil, and she said that the most terrible thing about fantasy is that whereas in reality what is the good is beautiful, inspiring, varied, fascinating, and evil is boring, flat, monotonous. In reality it's like that, but in fantasy it's the other way around. And I think that the offerings of the media, and especially television, support this view. Whatever is good is presented as flat and boring, and whatever is evil is made to seem exciting and attractive. And I wonder very much how long even the semblance of a civilized way of life will be able to withstand this perpetual erosion and transposition of the basic values of a Christian society. Incidentally, how extraordinary it is, and how significant perhaps, that the most clear voice that was raised against this transposition of values should have been that of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. That a man coming from the first avowedly atheistic society ever to exist on earth, disposing of stupendous power such as no government has ever exercised over all its citizens, controlling what they read, what they think, what they say, where they work, everything about them, that out of that society should have come this authentic voice of how we are losing our true freedom through the debauching, particularly of the young, and how we have lost sight of this basic good and evil round which human life, the drama of human life, revolves. If someone had said to me that such a thing could happen when I was a young journalist in Moscow in the early 30s, I should have said it's impossible. Such is the power of the state, such is the dedication of the state to destroying all such thoughts. But I would have been wrong. And it is perhaps a time when it's not always easy to find occasions for hope. I think that God has given us this extraordinary chance of seeing some light in a world that seems to be increasingly dark, that one man reared in such a society as that, subjected to 10 years in a labor camp, deprived by virtue of that situation of all contact with what is called civilization, should emerge in the West and tell us in such clear and splendid terms what is the matter. Now, there's no need for me to attempt to persuade you who are supporters of the Festival of Light, to persuade you on which side you stand, because I know that you stand on the same side as I do. At the same time, I think it's important that you should know from an outsider how tremendously important it is that your testimony as to what's happening and as to where you stand should be made through an organization of this kind. My own connection with the Festival of Light is only a tenuous one in a way, but at least it is true that I produced the name. Because what happened was this. Some 6 years ago, a young man, perfectly simple, good young Englishman of humble standing, who had been away for 3 years in India, came to see me because on his return to England, he was appalled by the deterioration of standards that had gone on during that 3 years. And as a matter of fact, let me break off to say that one of the things that is difficult to realize, even when one feels deeply concerned, the rapidity with which standards are falling. There was an experiment I read about of how some frogs were put in a bowl of water, and the water was heated very slowly and imperceptibly, so slowly that it got to boiling point and the frogs all died without making the slightest attempt to jump out because of the slowness with which the water had been heated. Now, the imagery will be clear to you. It is a simple empirical fact that I speak now of England because I know the circumstances there, but I'm pretty sure it's the same here. It is a simple empirical fact that films are being shown on in cinemas in London, perfectly respectable cinemas, which even 5 years ago could not have been shown even in the Soho cinemas that specialized in such blue films. It is an empirical fact that in England, in village newsagents, magazines are on free display, which would have been sold 5 years ago, would have been sold under the counter in the district, the Soho district, that specializes in such merchandise. And all this happens, we don't notice it happening, because like the water in which the frogs were immersed, the temperature is being raised imperceptibly. And the instrument for doing this is in fact the media. They provide a sort of world of fantasy in which people can and do live. Those of us like myself who have participated to a considerable degree in this medium of television are well aware of this themselves, because they know that we know that we are translated into a sort of fantasy ourselves by appearing on the screen. I had a rather curious example of this some little time ago when I'd been abroad and so had not been appearing at all on television, and was rather surprised to find people in the village I live in saying to me the same old cry, "I saw you on the telly." Rather admonitory remark that people make. I said that I haven't been on. And it turned out that there's a man called Yarwood, Mike Yarwood, who does an imitation of me, and he in fact has been more effective in being me than I am normally myself. Now, I mention this simply to illustrate the fact that this medium, which plays so fantastic a part in the lives of Western people, is the participants in it are themselves part of the fantasy. There is another example of the same thing. A newspaper ran a contest in which it gave a list of names of people, and the readers had to say which of them were fictitious names and which were real people. And I came out that my name is in the list. I came out that 61% of the readers thought I was a real person. So you see, there is this confusion between my score, I may say, was 2% better than the Reverend Ian Paisley's, so I had at least that small satisfaction. By the way, don't forget too about this question of the media and films, that television cannot run without old movies. Now, of course, it's been using up all these westerns and things for a long time, but very soon now, the old movies that will be shown on television are the films that are being used, most of which, or many of which, are pornographic and sadistic in character. So there's something that you have to watch. Because if it were possible, they were permitted, and I fear they may be, to pipe these films into people's sitting rooms, then we should have taken one more dreadful step in this degradation of our way of life. It's been a very curious experience for my wife and me during this month of October, going round in Australia and latterly in New Zealand, talking to people, arriving in places, having the same questions put, and to see them appear in the paper in the same distorted form, is why or how I became a Christian. Why this question interests me is that the one answer to it that apparently is inconceivable to the people who put it on behalf of their newspapers or their television networks or what it may be, is that I became a Christian because I reached this conclusion that Christianity was true. They seek always some other explanation. In my case, in view of my years, the favorite one being that I've reached an advanced stage of senility. This is fair enough, but it is an interesting reflection on our time. that this other answer, that just because it's true, is the one that seems to be escape their notice, because they are brainwashed into thinking that nobody today who was considered to be intelligent or part of the contemporary scene could possibly believe something that in fact, of course, has been believed during the last 20 centuries by the most eminent, the most cultivated, the most creative minds of the Western world. So it's been a strange experience. But out of it, surprisingly enough in a way, I've come to see something very, very clearly. More clearly than ever before. Perhaps two things, really. The first is that the presentation of our world on the media is by no means representative of the actual people of the West. You know, it's been a most delightful thing for me that, especially, of course, in England, having a face that's known to people through television and being known as someone who is an aspiring Christian, it very often happens that someone comes up to me or greets me or indicates in some way or another that he or she shares my view, is a fellow Christian. This is the most beautiful thing. Happens in all sorts of strange places. Air hostesses, even in a makeup room of all strange places. The girl, putting stuff on one's ancient old fizz, murmurs, whispers, "I love the Lord." Or a note comes, or something like that, all the time. So you have this marvelous sense of the wonderful community, family of Christians, which exists and which is never taken account of in the assumptions and calculations on which our lives are ordered. Well, that's one thing. And it's a very beautiful thing. I tell you something that related to it, which has been a very clear sort of enlightenment to me, and that is the great difference between the Christian idea of mankind as a family and of men and women as brothers and sisters, and the political idea of equality, of how extraordinarily different those two things are. The one being true in the sense that, of course, men are not, in the political sense, equal, but they are a family. In a family, you accept inequalities. You accept the idea that some are, one child is clever, another child is slow-witted, one is beautiful, another is plain, one may even be mentally disabled, a mongrel, and perhaps for that very reason, especially beloved. Whereas the political idea of equality, being untrue to life, instead of producing this marvelous brotherhood, produces strife, produces inequality, produces the Gulag Archipelago. This is one of the things that emerged very clearly. Now, also, very clearly the sense of man, Western man, at this time of crisis, when a choice has to be made. And I have concluded that the choice that has to be made is quite definitely and inescapably between the Christian view of life and the materialist view on which the present trends in our society are based. In other words, that you have absolutely unmistakably before you the reality that came to the world through the incarnation and that has provided our Western civilization with everything that's most precious in it, in its art, in its literature, in its values, in its music, in its architecture, in everything. And on the other, this world of fantasy that men are shaping since they gave up believing in God and considered that they were powerful and clever enough to shape their own way of life and their own human destiny. Now, these things absolutely clearly distinguished, representing a choice that has to be made. And I do not believe myself that there is any sort of compromise between those two things. I think we are at the parting of the ways. I think that within a very short time now, it will have to be, and it has to be now, for every single man and woman, one or the other. That either you succumb to this fantasy world in which there is no God, but only men, no good and evil, but only what is expedient and what is inexpedient, in which men believe, claim for themselves rights that in the world of reality they couldn't possibly have. The right to decide which children should be born and which should be killed before they're born. The right, ultimately, as you will find, will follow from that to the degree that human beings accept things like abortion, will follow absolutely inevitably as night follows day, that they will then claim the right to decide which lives are worthless and should be put out and which lives can be tolerated and should be allowed to continue. That will absolutely inexorably happen. And of course, in that case, there will be the further incentive for governments that enormous sums of money can be saved by getting rid of what will be called useless lives. The plea for abortion was unwanted children, something that is utterly untrue. The plea for euthanasia will be useless lives. It's a terrible slippery slope. The systematic degradation of our way of life through the pollution of words, through the pollution of ideas, through the pollution of the relations between men and women, through the destruction of the family and the pollution of the whole idea of love, so that the very word becomes unusable. On the one hand, that, and on the other, this terrible arrogance, whereby men abrogate to themselves the responsibilities and the decisions that can only be God's. And I would say to you that this is not a matter of abstract speculation. This is not a matter of any kind of pessimistic view of life. It is, in fact, a choice that our society will have to make. And at the present moment, the choice that it is making is all on the side of the fantasy, the arrogance, and the ultimate disaster. We have had in Britain, since the Abortion Act was passed, 3 million babies, 1 million babies destroyed. It's an appalling thought. And you see, again, on my heating the water up slowly, it is something that 5 years ago would have produced the most terrific shock in the population. But because of this conditioning process, it's accepted as something that is now part of our way of life. And that's the second point I wanted to say about the Festival of Light, that it is also tremendously important that you who feel as you do should assert yourself, should raise your voices, should face the ridicule that inevitably comes and the distortions and the insults that inevitably come, because thereby you can puncture to some extent this strange fatalism that the projection of a world of fantasy creates. People feel that somehow or other it's all got to happen. And I think that anyone who is in contact with public opinion would agree with me that this is a very sinister development. A sense that there's no doing anything about it. Now, of course, I know which side you're on. I know that you agree with all this. And I know you know about it all. But I do wish, addressing you tonight, and with a view to a larger meeting tomorrow, to stress to you, which might not be so clear, the urgency of the choice and of being aware that it is a parting of the ways, that we have reached this point in our way of life, and that if the process goes on much further, then it will become irreversible, and the corruption will have taken place with the inevitable consequences. Please don't think of me as simply producing pessimism, because this isn't pessimism. I know that the Christian faith, that the revelation that came into the world with Jesus is the most hopeful, the most crazily hopeful view of life that there can possibly be, because it shows us a way in which we can indeed be reborn. We can disengage ourselves from the things that drag us down and be reborn as different creatures. There could be no greater hope than this. And that hope, of course, is available, can be realized in all conceivable circumstances. But it is also true that men can collectively degrade their way of life to the point of disaster. And I consider that in hundreds of ways, some of which I've mentioned, others like the systematic corruption of children, almost too unbearable to mention, that process can take place, is taking place, and can have, for everything we care about, the most dreadful consequences. And I think it's important that it should be faced. There is this crisis in human affairs, in our affairs of the Western world. If you were to sit down and think what you would have thought 10 years ago of the present state of the Western world, you will see what I mean. It would never have occurred to you in your wildest dread that it could have happened. It has happened, it is happening, and the pace is quickening. The Festival of Light is a movement to draw attention to that, to express the wonderful alternative joys and hopes that the Christian faith offers, to say to everyone who will listen, there are many who see as we do what is happening, and to prepare the way for many, many others to follow. The Festival of Light means the light of the world, the light of everything that men have done, which is wonderful and beautiful and creative. Everything, all their achievements, their great achievements. And against that light is this darkness of a relapse into the limitations of time and mortality, the acceptance of our animal nature, and the pursuit of our ego as our highest effort. With those words, I stop.
See now, ladies and gentlemen, where I got my mixture of Paul of Tarsus and St. Francis of Assisi from, didn't you? The Muggeridges have been brought to Australia by the Bible Society of Australia and the Festival of Light, and here in Queensland, a collective representation of the Christian Church has worked together to form this committee. And we're pleased to welcome the Director of Festival of Light for Australia, Mr. Fred Nile, to say a few words.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. and Mrs. Muggeridge, distinguished guests, it's a great privilege to be able to share in this reception with so many people here from Queensland, and I see a few faces even from across the border in this particular function from Grafton. And it has been a wonderful experience to be able to travel around Australia and New Zealand with Mr. Muggeridge. It's about midnight according to his watch at the moment, because he left very early this morning from New Zealand to fly to Australia, and you know, with the time adjustment, it would make it about 12:30. We've had a tremendous response in all the cities to which Mr. Muggeridge has travelled. At all his meetings, it's been a very wonderful problem to have overflow crowds. We anticipated an overflow crowd in Sydney because there'd been so much anticipation of his visit to our land for almost 2 years. And so we did not even try to fit the crowds into the Opera House or the Sydney Town Hall. We simply took over the whole of Sydney Hyde Park on October the 10th, only a few weeks ago. And this is the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, which received almost, I understand, no coverage in Queensland or the other states. And in the Australian newspaper, the only national paper, it reported the meeting in a small column, giving as much attention to a protest group of 20 people as it did to the meeting itself. Now that's a little up-to-date example of some of the distortions that Mr. Muggeridge has been talking about, and the world of fantasy in which the media seem to exist.
How many people came?
Now, it was estimated that about 35,000 people were present, between 30 and 40,000 people. It's very difficult to count people in a park, but they just stretch as far as the eye could see, in all directions, and completely packed out that huge area, Sydney Hyde Park. We're very pleased to have had at that gathering the same sort of supporters you have here tonight, with leaders of all the churches and of the political parties and so on showing their support. But it was a very good demonstration of what our speaker's been bringing to us tonight, of people standing up to be counted. And as Mr. Muggeridge closed his remarks in that great gathering, he said, "If God be with us, who can be against us?" That huge crowd jumped to their feet in a spontaneous action and gave a standing ovation at the close of his remarks. As our chairman has said, Mr. Muggeridge is a genuine Christian, a humble man, and I suppose it's for us to say things about him which I believe are true. And when he speaks about Alexander Solzhenitsyn being raised up by God in these days, a modern miracle, to speak to the East as well as to the West to a degree, but particularly to the communist world, I believe God in a similar way has raised up Malcolm Muggeridge to speak to us in the West. And I know he doesn't like that. He'll rouse on me later for saying that, but that's what I believe. And as I've travelled with him, it's becoming clearer and clearer to me every moment. On the table in front of each person present here, the Labor Committee has produced a very attractive kit of material, which I just draw your attention to its contents. There's a folder, background sheet on the Festival of Light, in which the Labor Committee has tried to answer questions about it. Again, because of the distortions that occur so often in the media, it's obvious sometimes that people are building an image based on this fantasy, but not on fact. And so we're simply here, the committee has listed questions and answers. How did the Festival of Light begin? Why use the name Festival of Light? And so on. Why do we need a Festival of Light? And I believe the answers are very apt, as we've been hearing tonight. Over the page, what are the aims of the Festival of Light are clearly listed. How is it organised? What are its methods? Bearing in mind that in about 2 or 3 years, nearly 1 million pieces of literature have been produced and given away right across Australia. Paragraph 7, what are the characteristics of the Festival of Light, which puts it into the language that you can use. And over the page, 8, what does Fole care about? And then last of all, what can you do about it? And has been indicated by Mr. Muggeridge, it is time that people who do share these pro-Christian views, Christians and people of goodwill, stand together in our society, for the hope of our society and for the hope of the future generations of young Australians, that they will have an opportunity to make some choices, that if some of the minority groups have their way, they will not have those choices to make in the kind of lives that they choose to live. Some people have said, been disappointed perhaps, that the Festival of Light in Queensland has not made a greater impact than it has. And this is a note just from the local committee, not from me. I believe they've done a very good job, but they'd like to just indicate that they have been very restricted by the lack of finance and have, in the last 2 years, received about $2,300 in donations and subscriptions, all of which has been used in their printing and postage and so on. And secondly, that they have no full-time staff, and so this particular program here in Queensland at this tonight's function, with the cooperation of the Council of Churches and other groups, and the rally tomorrow night, have been organised by volunteers. It's a good way to do it, but sometimes more can be done if there is an office and staff. And we hope that as a result of this visit this weekend, the local committee hope that there may be sufficient support by people joining the Festival of Light or making donations, so that they can engage a state organiser and a female secretary to handle correspondence, a simple office, making the note here that the Humanist Society and other small groups with only a handful of members have offices in Brisbane, and are very active in influencing the media, the school groups, university situations and so on. And in cooperation with the churches, it would be very important and I believe very valuable to have some sort of office here in Queensland which can assist in this sort of program that Mr. Muggeridge has been talking about. And then tonight there may be amongst the audience here a solicitor or a barrister who could advise on legal matters. I remember Lady Bennett saying she had a barrister somewhere in her family. A journalist who could write articles for newspapers. We can't get Mr. Muggeridge back every week. We need our own people to do that. A media specialist who can help with public relations. A resource personnel who can give the Christian viewpoint in some of these issues that have been raised, and so on. So there are many, many things you can do to help, and on the back of that little folder, there's a membership form you can fill in and tear out, and people will then have you on a mailing list, and you'll get mail, magazines, bulletins, and so on. Some people have said to me as I've travelled around, I never hear about the Festival of Life. I never see these magazines. Well, the only way that the office could send it to you is by you first sending in your name and address. And if you send it in, I'm sure the Queensland Committee will keep you fully informed. Thank you for your support here tonight and for your prayers and interest. God bless you.
Deputy Premier Mr. Knox, Your Grace, Archbishop Rush, our two guests, Mr. and Mrs. Muggeridge, and distinguished guests, it's my pleasure to call on my Lord Bishop, who's a personal friend of mine, who I know will understand when I say that because he's chaplain, resident chaplain at Channel O, we're just going to have just a minute for the thanks and benediction. In his with his expert efficiency, in a succinct way, I'm sure that I can ask him now to close this formal part of the meeting with thanks and benediction. My Lord Bishop of Bishop Weeks.
Let us pray. Loving Father, we thank and praise you for the fellowship together we have known in Jesus Christ this evening. We thank you and praise you for the inspiration and power that there has been amongst us. We thank you for the inspiration of our visiting speaker here tonight, for the great challenge he gives to us in your name. We thank you that you have raised up Malcolm Muggeridge in our time to give us a vision of a Christian society. We thank you that the light of the world is being rekindled in our time. We praise you for all the good that comes from the work of the Festival of Light. And may grace, and mercy, and peace and power be with us all this night and evermore. Amen.